Welcome to the This Is Money show, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lambert and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost. Here alongside Simon Nye is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And on the agenda today, as estate agents report the lowest stock of properties for nearly 40 years and political uncertainty weighs on the minds of buyers and sellers alike, we ask, is a major house price crash around the corner? The rise of the gig economy may have been brilliant for reluctant cooks, lazy travellers and dodgy DIYers. But can the same be said for the workers? Is more protection needed? We investigate why car insurance has rocketed. We take a peek at Jaguar's latest offering, its new baby SUV. And shield your eyes, John Lennon's old psychedelic roller is back in town. All that and plenty more coming up. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, are we on the brink of a major 90s-style house price collapse? Perhaps if you're a professor at LSE. Nah, if you're Russell Quirk, CEO of eMove.
We can all wheel out the occasional sort of professor from somewhere that has one extreme view or another on the housing market. There's a wonderful site called housepricecrash.com, and for about the last 10 years or more, they've been predicting the crash in UK property prices. And I guess it's like a broken clock. They may well end up being right twice a day. However, to contend on the basis of no evidence really, but just a view of someone that actually, in fairness, used to be an advisor to the government on housing, but we kind of know how housing and governments mix. We don't tend to get the result that the government says that they're going to get in terms of housing supply, at least. So we got an expert saying that because he's seen this slight drop in the rate of increase in house prices over the last 3 months, that therefore that equals a crash. And that's pretty crazy, really. It's, I think, designed to grab a headline. For property prices to drop by 40%, you would have to see a remarkable decrease in demand and probably significant increases in interest rates and money costs. I think the chances of the UK property market seeing a 40% drop in values is absolutely infinitesimal. It's simply not going to happen. We still have a huge imbalance between demand for property, growing population, cheap money, versus a real lack of supply because not enough houses are being built consistently.
So Russell Quirk sitting on the fence there. While house prices are still going up, depending though on who you listen to, estate agents reporting the lowest stock of properties for nearly 40 years, the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors found political uncertainty, more than Brexit, is weighing on our minds. They say the market is in a state of lethargy and could continue flatlining for a while. But the picture, as always, is not uniform across the country. So Simon Lee, just to prove why I hate house price stats, the Halifax reporting prices fell by 1% in June, with annual growth slipping to 2.6%. The RICS survey suggests property values actually rose during the month. Podcast pass, do listen to Simon's very extensive explanation of why house price stats are all over the shop, but I cannot be bothered to go down that route. So apologies, Lee, you're going to describe what's going on. Are we at the beginning of a major house price correction?
It's very hard to say, Georgie, and this is fence sitting at its finest. There's so many property indexes, right? So there's a whole raft of them that show what it's a sort of snapshot of what's happening in the last 12 months and what's happening on a monthly basis as well. So nationwide, for June, they're saying that house prices went up.
But why are they all different?
It's based on their own lending book. So it kind of sometimes does paint a different picture. It's sort of a wider picture. And we did once upon a time, didn't we, Simon? We used to keep an eye on all of them and sort of have a monthly rolling index of where they were all going. But it's just, to be honest with you, George, you've got to take these indexes with a bit of a pinch of salt. And even the government's official stats, the ONS ones, you know, they were out of kilter with a lot of what's being reported and a lot of what's going on. So, you know, are we facing a massive house price crash? Well, part of me really doesn't think so. I mean, the demand is still there. The supply is low. That RICS survey, you know, the lowest amount of properties to buy for 40 years. And even though a lot of people are struggling to get on the housing ladder, a lot of people still are trying to get onto the housing ladder. So there is that sort of demand there. Not enough homes are being built. So for that reason, there's a big strain on the property market still. So I just can't see a massive crash. 40% is just ridiculous. You remember when George Osborne was saying there was going to be a big crash after Brexit?
And that was only 18%.
I know, that was only
18%.
That's really tiddly in comparison. The key thing, I think, actually, with these house price indexes, and one thing to keep, really keep your eye on, and Simon will agree with me on this, and I know he hammers this home a lot, is the price to earnings ratio of how much it actually you're having to borrow to buy a property. And it, when it starts stretching above the 5 or 6 times, you know, ratio, it starts to look a little bit frightening.
We're so almost 8%, aren't we?
That's quite a high level if you think, really think about it. And it's a quite worrying level of mortgage debt that people are taking on in order to get onto the property market. It's going to be heavily skewed places like London, even though London wages are a little bit higher than elsewhere. The property prices are way higher than elsewhere. Mm. And a lot of people might be overstretching themselves. And we've gone through a real period of low interest rates, and mortgage rates are at rock bottom lows. You know, people are paying back real sort of peanuts, not peanuts, but, you know, far lower than what they could be if interest rates do start to come up. And that's where we could start facing real problems. But in the case of a massive house price crash, I just can't see it. There's a lot of our readers that are predicting a big crash in property prices. You know, prices have gone up astronomically in the last 5 to 10 years, but I just can't see them falling at the same pace.
Right, Simon, talk about political uncertainty, not Brexit. The RICS survey took a look at sentiment. It wasn't stats. What are your views, especially with the regional variation?
Well, I liked Russell Quirk's Michael Gove-style debunking of an expert there. And I think that if you read the story in question, where we'd spoken to the expert from the LSE, Alex Hawkes, who wrote this for the Mail on Sunday, said, Cheshire's view differs from that of the main forecasters because it's not a prediction based on analysis of several collections of data and models of the economy. Instead, it is an observation based on his research showing the huge volatility in UK house prices. The housing market across the whole of England is on average substantially more volatile than any single metropolitan area in the whole of the US, Cheshire said. So when falls come, they can be substantial. The shortage of homes, which others say helps prop up the market, also contributes to the huge volatility. He said, economists are pretty good at understanding the fundamentals, but they are not at all good at predicting turning points in the markets. So he was saying there's a chance that this could happen, but he can't say it's going to happen now. Now, what you need for a house price crash is a number of ingredients. First of all, you need house prices to have risen to a high level, where if you were going to measure them on a metric of value, you would say houses are now overvalued. Now, what's the easiest thing to measure them against? You get all kinds of measurements depending on, like, your monthly mortgage, how much the mortgage interest costs you, servicing the debt and everything like that. The real measurement is against wages. And what tends to happen is you have a boom, it pushes them up, they get to a very high point against wages, and then they collapse. And you, in order to get that boom, you need some form of major credit event. So you need to push up those house prices much faster than wages would push them up, or demand would push them up themselves. Supply and demand of houses in the market, it's on the edges of it, really. It's more about the supply and demand of credit. Over the years, we've had a couple of periods when house prices have risen by a lot. 1970s, they rose by a lot. There was a period in the 1980s when they rose by a lot before coming to a grinding halt at the end of the 80s, start of the 90s. They then didn't go anywhere until about 1997, when they then picked up. And then from about 2000 to 2007, they went absolutely crazy. Then the credit crunch, financial crisis happened. They fell quite a bit, and the decline was arrested by dropping interest rates. If you look at all of those periods of time, 1970s, why did house prices go up by a lot? Well, actually there you had very high inflation and very high wage inflation. So actually they weren't really going up by that much if you compare them to the wages. 1980s, deregulation of the banks, basically. So it used to be that only building societies could lend money to people for mortgages, and there was quite tight controls on how they lent that money. And that was deregulated, and the banks stepped in. All of a sudden, there was a big rush of credit that went all the way through that booming decade of the late 80s. And then effectively, it ran out of steam. There was changes made to being able to offset your mortgage interest against your tax bill. But there was a period of grace allowed, so everyone went completely bananas buying houses for a period of time that stoked the market up even higher, a lot like the buy-to-let tax changes we just saw. And then the property market collapsed, and then it remained in the doldrums for about 6 years. So you listen to all these people saying about how much money people have made in terms of property over the last 20 years. And the reason why people made so much money in property if they bought one 20 years ago is because 20 years ago, houses were cheap, basically, compared to wages. They went up about 2000 to 2007. You then had the whole credit explosion all around the world, the slicing and dicing of mortgages. It wasn't just US subprime that all of this money was flowing into. It had interest rates kept very, very low.
because inflation was low, but we were importing low inflation from China, so interest rates were lower than they should have been. People, they weren't watching out properly for what was going on. House prices boomed. 2007, you had the financial crisis, sudden stopping in credit because banks wouldn't lend to each other, let alone to borrowers anymore. Interest rates shot up because banks basically put up the price of their mortgages. So they didn't want to lend, so they whacked up the price of the mortgages. People couldn't borrow money, and house prices fell substantially. And that decline was arrested eventually by the lack of forced sellers, because interest rates were cut to 0.5%. And that saved a lot of people who otherwise would have found themselves in a 1990s style position where they were losing their jobs and they were unable to keep up with their mortgage payments, or their mortgage payments were so high because they'd spent too much money on the house. But whereas the difference between the 1990s scenario and the 2007 scenario was, in 2007, interest rates were cut right to the bone. The 1990s was the period when we were talking about 10% interest rates. So you've got to have the credit event, the boom, and then some form of sudden stop of credit or something that knocks the market off the event. Have we had the credit event this time round? Not in the same way, but yes, we have, because look at how cheap interest rates are. So we have stopped house prices falling at a point when they were already more expensive above wages, and then we've allowed them to continue to rise. So maybe we have had the credit event, but are we going to see the thing that stops that credit right now? I don't think so. 2 years' time, after the banks have probably loosened up, gone a little bit crazy, thrown money at people who shouldn't be able to borrow the money, watch out for the indicators that show that stuff going on. Because at some point, we are going to have another house price crash. And it will be a big one, because houses are very, very, very expensive right now.
Lee, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about student loans, right? I think we might have found the solution. Just get Simon to do lectures like that on history and economics. It would save a ton of money, Simon. You've so got a little cottage industry going on there. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for that explanation. All right, then, from house price stats to weighty reports, the fun times keep rolling, lads. We had two out this week, not house price stats. That would be far too low a number for 1 week. Reports, I mean. One on pension freedoms. The other one that's got everyone talking, particularly around Simon Streets anyway, is the Taylor Review. Yes, from the Deliveroo riders who Simon Tellers listened to podcast Pass congregate near his home. Good customer, Simon, or just anyway. To Uber drivers and general odd jobbers, the gig economy has taken off spectacularly. 1.1 million now working on a casual basis. But there's been an increasing concern, especially after some high profile cases, about workers' rights and treatment, job insecurity, and the impact of that on things like getting a mortgage. So Theresa May called for a probe, and this week Matthew Taylor, former advisor to Tony Blair, well, he delivered. No pun intended there. What did he recommend, though? Firstly, if you wouldn't mind, one of you going into just slightly more detail than I have about what on earth is the gig economy, who works in it, the pros and the cons, the arguments.
Well, the idea is that you are, rather than an employee of someone, contracted to do a certain number of hours per week, or not do a certain number of hours if you've got a 0 hours contract, you work on your own terms. So you sign up with them, and if you wake up in the morning and you decide, I fancy working today, you can get your phone out, see if anybody wants any takeaways delivered. Probably unlikely first thing in the morning, but maybe you've woken up in the evening, decided, do I want to do any work this evening? You get your phone out, have
Is
a look at your
related
phone,
to mobile
see if there's
phones
any takeaways that
tech?
Want to be delivered. Well, the technology has dramatically changed right. This. I remember reading something from someone who said, this isn't that different to when they were growing up and people used to go down the docks and see if there was any work going that day and people would be picked out, or people would go down to some of the sites where people could get construction workers. But obviously technology enables you to do this on a much better scale, because in this instance, you just sign on to your phone, check it, right, there's work to be done. I'll do that work. When I've done that work, do I want more work? Do I want to keep working, or do I want to knock off? And so there's this idea that it's a bit of a gig.
But the reality is, the way you describe that makes it sound as though you can do what you like. But we've heard in court cases recently that actually that's not quite the case.
No. If you are the supporter of the gig economy, or a person involved in the tech companies that provide the technology behind the gig economy and don't necessarily make lots of money but are extremely highly valued in terms of the company's value itself, then you probably think that the gig economy is awesome. If you are working in the gig economy, You're meant to think that it's awesome, but many people don't seem to think that it's awesome at all. And they actually think that they end up working for less than the minimum wage in cases, some cases, that they don't get the holiday pay, the sick pay, the pension contributions that other people are entitled to by the law. And that actually they're only doing this because they can't really get a job doing something else. And they feel that they're being taken advantage of. And it's very difficult to put yourself on a line anywhere between the two and say one of those is absolutely right. I think that the concerns of the people working in the gig economy are very, very valid, but those are not the concerns of everyone working in the gig economy. There's lots of non-vocal people in the gig economy who are perfectly happy driving Ubers, who actually have switched from driving a minicab to driving an Uber. There's lots of people who've said that Deliveroo, for example, has been absolutely brilliant for their teenage kids who've just left school, because all they need to earn some money is a mobile phone and a bicycle. Otherwise, they're struggling to get a job, and it gets them out of the house, gets them earning some money. It's not really a long-term career choice, and it's not the old-fashioned social contract between employer and employee.
No, but the flexibility is very useful. Perhaps you're in between jobs, like you say, perhaps you're young and you don't have the experience, perhaps you're disabled and can't commit to a full-time job in that way. So that is why any of these sort of reviews are going to be very, very difficult. But what did he essentially come up with in this review, Matthew Taylor, looking at it? Did he say that they need more protection, and what sort of protection would be offered?
Well, he did say that he wanted more protection for these workers. He said that they should receive minimum wage and sick pay in an overhaul of employment law.
And call it something
else,
didn't
he? And there was talk of bringing in a new category of worker, a dependent contractor, alongside employed and self-employed. So traditionally, you've got employed people, does what it says on the tin,
you're employed
by a company, you get the full shebang. Yeah. You've got self-employed people who are responsible for providing themselves with the full shebang, and which is quite expensive, actually, you discover if you go self-employed. And actually what happens is they normally end up just missing out on the full shebang. And then you've got this new category that's going to be put in, because really, if you are working in the gig economy,
you have workers as well, not quite the full shebang.
Yeah, if you're working in the gig economy, you're not really employed and you're not really self-employed. You're a cross between the two. Now, there was one really interesting bit the other day, which was talking about the minimum wage element. The idea is that you might continue to allow people to work for less than the minimum wage if they wanted to. They might find that actually the demand was not high enough to pay them enough money to take home the minimum wage, but they could still choose to go and do that work if it was their choice. And that's a quite controversial bit.
All right. What was also mentioned as well in the report, they were pushing, like we heard from Visa as well this week, to move to a cashless society and electronic payments to encourage us to make the right choices, which I thought was rather interesting from Matthew Taylor there. So every time we pay builders, cleaners, babysitters, cash in hand, we aren't being good citizens, is that right, Lee?
I had this dilemma in the last couple of weeks, actually, Georgie. I've had both the window cleaner and I've had a builder around doing work in my property. And one said that had to pay by backs, couldn't take cash for tax reasons, and the other one just wanted cash. I won't tell you which one was which, but it's true. This has been a real popular topic with our readers, and it's really been a hot topic of whether or not you should pay cash to builders, to babysitters, because the likelihood is they're not going to be paying tax on that money. So it's almost like a tax black hole. And what the report was saying is that it could help claw back £6 billion a year in taxes lost to what Mr. Taylor described as the black economy, of where this money just goes in a sort of vortex. So the suggestion there is that we shouldn't be paying in cash, and that we should be doing things like backs transfers, but people really don't like it.
It's funny. Sorry, the title got me. I don't know who wrote the article, apologies, or the subeditor who wrote the title of it, but it was like middle class shock and horror, fury at having to pay cash. I didn't realise this was such a big issue.
It's huge, Georgia. We've had various stories over the years. I think we've even had an open-ended question on there. Should you be paying cash to builders?
What gets people so het up? I don't get
it. It's the tax element, isn't it? Because, you know, if you're a normal worker and you're getting taxed at your pay, you know, you're getting fairly taxed, and that tax then goes on and pays for various things, you know, services around the country. If you're a builder and you're just getting cash in hand and you're not, you know, paying the right amount of tax as everyone else, it's a real sore subject, isn't it? Because you're getting taxed what is the correct amount, whereas builders and babysitters aren't.
But surely you have a say in that. You can decide whether or not you pay someone cash or you work, you know.
Well, this is the whole argument, yeah.
Well, yeah, and there was a great column today, actually, by Tom Utley in the Daily Mail, who basically was talking about the work that he's been having done at his house and the whole not being told he shouldn't be paying in cash kind of thing. And he was saying that he's not going to pay them in cash to dodge tax, but he thinks that he should still have the choice as to whether he can pay them in cash or not. And that's what people don't like. He said, it's up to me to make the moral choice. Mm. I am a moral agent. I have to make the moral choice. The person who accepts the money has to make the moral choice. But we should be left that choice. We shouldn't be enforced, you can't pay cash. And I think that that's what upsets people so much about it. They don't trust people saying to them, you won't be able to pay in cash.
Exactly.
It's that kind of thing. And also, I think that whilst most people think that people should pay their taxes and pay their dues, they also have a little bit of them that thinks that there's nothing wrong with earning a little bit of money that's untaxed. They think that basically people should be paying tax on their wages and the money that they earn, but they also have this little bit of them that thinks people should be able to do the odd job here and there for a bit of cash in hand. And I think that that's just human nature. And I think that, so you might find, so if you're a brickie, if you're a bricklayer or a builder, and you do all your jobs cash in hand, you are going to, and don't pay any tax, you are going to come a cropper eventually, because the tax man is going to come after you, because it's going to be really obvious that you're not earning any money, yet you seem to somehow be eking out some form of existence. However, if you do pretty much all of your jobs officially and pay the money to the tax man, and then occasionally you do a little bit of extra work that you wouldn't otherwise do and get paid in cash, I think that's the kind of thing that a lot of people don't object to. Now, whether that is right or whether that is wrong is something for a much longer moral debate. But I think that's what underlies a lot of this.
I think also there's two other things at play here as well, Georgie. If, when you start saying to people we're cashless society and you know, everything's going to have a trail, people start to get worried about the tax man start accessing your accounts and seeing what your ins and outs are, and that worries people. And I think the second element is that actually there has been a lot of these stories in the past where these big global firms haven't paid their fair share of tax in Britain, and people got start going, well, why are you going after the little guy and you're not going after the big guy? And I think that's the other two elements at play.
Theresa May distancing herself from moving closer to this cashless society.
Yeah, well, maybe she's on the side of the plucky little blue-collar tax avoider, like the rest of the nation. She's getting in hand with the rest of the nation, siding with the tradesman who just likes to avoid a little bit of tax here and there. I had an interesting one the other day, actually. I had to take my car into a garage. The guy actually looked, the owner himself, they said they didn't have time, but I needed it that night. I needed to go on a long journey. And the owner said, look, I'll take it out, I'll test it, I'll see if it's all right, because it smelled a bit like fuel. He had a tune around of the engine. He said, I've got it running as good as I can, I think it's fine, I'll just charge you for my time. He said, it's £25. So he told the guy who works for him to charge me £25. So I went into the office to do this, and the guy started doing a whole invoice and everything, and I was in a hurry, I needed to leave. I said, it's all right, you don't need to bother giving me an invoice or anything, I'll just give you the cash, it's fine, don't worry about giving me a receipt or an invoice or putting it through the system or anything like that, I'll just pay you in cash because I need to go. And I wasn't saying I'll do all of this so that you can avoid tax, I was saying I'll do all of this so I can leave right now rather than spending 5 minutes waiting for you to give me an invoice and everything like that I don't need. And the guy said, oh no, I can't do that, I've got to put it through the system. I said, no, I wasn't trying to get you to avoid the tax, I was just trying to make life easier for you. He's like, no, I've got to put everything through the system.
See, we'd like to point out, exactly, not everybody is dodging tax in this area, but interestingly Matthew Taylor wasn't the only one pushing this idea of a cashless society. Visa, I understand, Lee, am I right in thinking that they're offering businesses in America $10,000 if they go cashless? Now, why I particularly am a bit het up about all this, I'll tell you, Lee, is because I got hacked again, twice in under 9 months, for my debit card, my current account. So I had to cancel my card, and I've been without it 6 days. 6 days they said it would take. Actually, it's longer because it was Friday through Friday. Do you know when they got that, Lee? 2 days ago. So my card has been sat in branch for 2 days and nobody bothered to tell me. But surely, what would I have done if I hadn't have taken cash out to pay for it? I don't want to pay things on a credit card. I don't have one.
How is that an acceptable banking behaviour in the 21st century that it took you that long to get a bank card? I mean, ridiculous. Especially when some high street banks, you get a card instantly. I mean, that's crazy to take that amount of time.
What is the justification with that?
Well, a lot of it is to do with making sure you don't fall victim of fraud again. So if you've asked for it to be in branch,
because they were so careful it's got the first time.
Well, exactly. I mean, have they given you an explanation as to where you know where this fraud's happened? Like, what was the starting point? Was it when you were on holiday and it was cloned, or did they even know? Do you even have an answer?
No.
You don't know, do you?
No.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, that is an unacceptable amount of time, I would say, to be without a bank card. And you know, dare I say it, I would be asking for a little bit of compensation, Georgie.
Oh, Lee. Oh, I hadn't even thought about it. Simon's perked up.
Yes, I got some money off Nationwide the other week.
Anything to do with this or just generally?
My colleague over there told me to play hardball and demand more. No, it was a catalogue of errors that started with my wife asking for a new bank card in her married name. Now, bear in mind that me and my wife will have been married for 9 years this summer. They've had ample opportunity to send her this card in her married name, but they just keep sending her ones in her maiden name. Brilliantly, she's also had a mortgage with them in the meantime in her married name. So she phoned them up, needed a new card, and said, could you send it to me in my married name? It's causing me problems. First of all, she failed security because they started asking her the names of her savings accounts, which she didn't know the names of her savings accounts. And then after calling them back, she was then sent another card in her maiden name. Swiftly afterwards, sent her another card in her married name. Shortly after that, I noticed that my card on this joint account stopped working properly. And I actually thought it was just the Sainsbury's at the end of my road where it was just being dodgy. And I must have got confused with another bank card. But eventually I phoned up the building society and said, please, could you send me another card? Because my card appears to have stopped working for some reason. And they told me that that was because they put a stop on my card. I said, well, why did you put a stop on my card without telling me? And the reason why they put a stop on my card without telling me is because when they'd sent out my wife's new card, I don't know whether it was number one or number two, I think it was number two, they'd cancelled mine and sent me a new card as well, but they hadn't told me and hadn't received it either.
Why? Because some strange woman, Mrs. Lambert, because been using in order to get
the name changed on it, they had to force it through the system or something by cancelling my card as well. I said, why didn't you tell me? So anyway, this saga continued for a period of time. And they did say that they would send me a new card. I said, please do make sure that you send me a new card, not my wife another card, and don't cancel hers. So they cancelled the card they sent me that had just disappeared into the ether. They get you a new card. It'll be with you within 3 to 5 working days. I said, well, can't you send it out any quicker than that?
Six.
And they said, no, we send them. I said, can't you get it couriered to me? He said, no, we send them by first class post. I said, well, why does it take 3 to 5 working days then? First class post is the next day. I said, so hang on a minute. That you're blaming the delay on the post. But actually, it's not the post. It's you printing the card. I said, why don't you just print the card quicker and send it out to me? Anyway, I made a complaint. I spoke to the complaints team and I got some money off them. So well done, Nationwide, because you apologised and you gave me some money. You did make a mistake, but you did apologise. You did give me some money, so thank you very much.
All right, then. I'll try it, and I'll let you know next week how unsuccessful it'll probably take about 6 days to actually get through to the complaints department.
It's true, but they should give you a reason as to why this keeps happening and where it originates from. And if you're not getting any sort of concrete answer and the inconvenience of not having a bank card for almost a week, I would say suggest you deserve a little bit of payback, especially when you can get 0.01% on your savings.
Well,
you've got to be dishing out cash somewhere for it.
I have a 0.01% savings account, although that might be a little bit high at the moment. What annoyed me about it was I said, out of convenience, because I'm not in Surrey, I'm in London this week, can you get it sent to a London branch? Yep, no problem. You know what, Miss Frost, it's fine. It probably will arrive before 6 days. Great. Will you phone me to let me know? No, we'll send a letter to your house.
By second class post.
I just don't even know where to go with that one. Right, we did start on the gig economy, but we'll put all that to one side. But we will stick with the jobs theme. And if the gig economy does not appeal to you, but you do fancy a new job, then chances are you will have to have an interview at some stage. Now, I don't know about you, but I absolutely hate interviews. Come the time that they ask you, do you have any questions for us? I am already mentally dialing up the other half to have a moan or ordering a consolatory drink in the pub. But this final interview question could be more important than perhaps I think. Here's interview expert and trainer James Innes of the CV Centre, who told us why companies ask that question.
Well, I think it's obviously a matter of politeness. You know, when they've been asking all the questions, to turn around and give you the opportunity to ask some questions. But also, it's certainly something important to see how sort of reactive you are. I saw a survey the other day. 29% of recruiters said a candidate not asking questions or asking poor questions was sufficient reason to fail them. I think it's important, very important, to choose your questions carefully. think of the questions you should avoid, things like asking questions about the organisation, which a quick look at their website could have answered. I personally think it's important to avoid asking questions about pay and holidays and things like that. My opinion is that bringing up issues like that during the interview places too much focus on what you're expecting from the employer rather than what you're offering them. So plan in advance. Think carefully through your questions. I personally think it's important to phrase your questions as if you've already bagged the job. It's like a psychological technique. So think about the future. What's expected of you? You can ask, what are my top priorities for the first 6 months in the job? Or how would you describe the team I will be working with? Phrasing it as if you've already got the job projects self-confidence and will also help to further persuade the interviewer that you are the right candidate for the job. It helps to have things that will make you stand out. I like particularly sort of what you might call an advanced technique, which is to ask the interviewer whether they have any reservations about your application, and if so, what they are. Now, obviously, it takes a bit of nerve, but, you know, again, it projects self-confidence. You can uncover any possible objections the interviewer might have to hiring you, and then obviously counterattack effectively. It can make all the difference. So try to identify what they might have against your application, what they might feel is a weak point for you, and that gives you one last opportunity to make a sales pitch.
What can I do? Give me the job! Okay, Lee, so you've got a new series to help people like me out. Tell me more.
Firstly, say that was some very sound advice.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? James Inn is there, CV Centre.
Really good advice, actually, and it was a very interesting stat that about almost a third of interviewers saying that if there was a bad question or no question at the end of an interview, actually that was reason enough to not offer someone a job, which is sort of trying to treat this. So this is a new series that we've started up called the Interview Cheat Sheet. We're going to be exploring sort of more, I wouldn't say obscure, but a little bit more sort of, you know, unusual elements of a job interview that perhaps haven't been done loads to death, you know, how to write the perfect CV, you know, that's been done a million and one times, things like that. We're going to be looking at sort of a little bit more out of the box. Mm-hmm. So this one, it came from someone who was talking about a job interview, and I thought it'd gone really well. But at the end, you know, they kind of sat through the interview, and at the end they asked, you know, do you have any questions? And that is the natural end to any interview. You're always pretty much going to get that question.
Yeah.
And they froze. They said they just froze. They just hadn't thought about that part. They hadn't planned any questions for at the end. And said, you know, do I just say no? Does that make me look lazy if I don't ask any questions? Do you go to the opposite end, get really bolshy, start saying, what are the perks? You know, have you got a table tennis table? You know, that sort of thing. You know, or even just to say something like, you know, what's your coffee machine like? You know, what is the right thing to do? So we asked...
It's really hard though, isn't it?
It is, but lots of the elements of an interview, they're not there to trip you up, but it's to see how assertive you are and how much you can handle the pressure of an interview situation, which may not have even much of a relation to the job, but it just kind of... It says a lot about you, how you answer these things. We've had loads about unusual questions that you get asked in an interview that have no correct answer. People really do trip up on those sort of questions because there is no correct answer, and people really do get quite flustered. And an interview already is quite a tricky process, you know, especially if it's like a dream job. If it's something you really, really want, you know, the pressure's on.
Yeah. And but also, this surely, it should be asked as a question that is a genuine question. Do you have any questions for us? Because surely if you're going for a job, it should be as much they interview you as you interview them.
Exactly. So, and that's the point that the experts have made in our first interview sheet series here, is actually, you know, it is your chance to sort of pose some sensible questions, you know, that demonstrate that you've taken the process seriously. You know, any good sort of interview candidate would have already swatted up on the knowledge of the company and be able to answer simple questions about what the company does, and especially if it is a company that you've wanted to work for a long time. But I think that the best advice in this, when you get asked a question at the end, I mean, it's always circumstantial, so you have to have your wits about you. You can't just sort of like parrot fashion some of these tips that we've been given. But I think always quite a solid one is, you know, as you're saying about psychological thinking, like talking like you've almost bagged a job without being overconfident, but asking a little bit more about the future. You know, is there chances to progress up the ladder at a company, for example? Because it's making you look like you've already, it makes you sound like you're already thinking that you've got the job without seeming overconfident, but then also thinking about the future and how you could stay loyal to this company by moving up the ladder. So I think questions about the future are pretty good. And also, you know, things about, you know, can you show me around the office or can I meet the team? Because also, it's not just beneficial for yourself to see what the office is like and to see what your potential future colleagues are going to be like. It's also beneficial for them to see if you're going to be a good fit. So this is the sort of advice that we're looking at in this cheat sheet series. And hopefully it'll be handy to people that do get you know, stuck on certain elements of a job interview. As you say, it can be a very, very stressful experience.
Thank you very much. I'll road test them, maybe. I'll let you know. Simon, though, you're a boss, and I bet you've asked this question a fair few times. What are some of the best and worst answers you've had? What did Lee say?
I didn't have an interview.
All right, then.
I just turned up.
You were just that good, Lee. You were poached, weren't you?
I just collected a few tokens off the back of a cereal box and sent them in, and I came in. Now, I started on work experience. Best thing, obviously, to do work experience is make lots of tea. Yeah. That's it. They can't get rid of you then.
We had the luxury of deciding whether we liked him over a period of time.
How good is his tea,
a period
Simon?
Of time in which he was making us tea. There's a lot to be said for that, getting a foot in the door and being useful and helpful and always putting your hand up when someone needs something doing or asking if I can help and doing things well and doing things, you know, relatively swiftly. And if there's any questions that need to be asked, asking the questions. There's a lot to be said for that. Lee's not the only person who's started work at This Is Money through that. And I got my first job in journalism through doing work experience as well at the local newspaper. So it really is a great way to get a job, to be honest. I think a lot of the time when you ask people the question, do you have any questions for us? It can sometimes be a little bit of a throwaway question. You've been doing a lot of talking. You've been describing the organisation. You've been asking the person lots of questions already. If a person is doing well at the interview, they will have already been asking you questions throughout the interview, because it is a conversation. It is a dialogue. It's not just you talking at them and then making them answer questions for you. I always try to treat interviews as really kind of an exploration between myself and the other person. Are they going to fit? Are they going to do good work? What's their background? What's their experience? But what do they think of us? I have to sell the job and working for us to them. It's important. I think that's a really good piece of advice for people who do interviews, is to remember that it's not just the interviewee selling themselves to you. You're selling working for your company and why it's a good idea to them. I think some of the good questions that people ask are around things like the practicalities and the accomplishments. I think what a great question is, what do you expect me to accomplish in the first 6 months in the role? What do you expect me to accomplish in the job? That's a good one, because it's positive as well. It's saying, I've already got the job now, what do you want me to do? Or saying something like, outside of this role, what is the thing that I could really do to help you? I remember hearing one of my bosses once say, people are always asking me for things, but they never ask me what they can do for me. But I think there's one question in here that I definitely wouldn't ask. There is no such thing as the perfect candidate. So what parts of the ideal candidate description are you prepared to compromise on? I can't see that one going down too well.
Love that one.
And also, I think it is a shame that I do think that element that was expressed by our expert earlier about don't ask too much about the pay, the perks, the hours, the things like that in the interview at that final question. There is an element of truth in that, but I think it's a bit sad because we forget that people need to be rewarded for doing their work, and you should be trying to sell them their awards. And maybe we've moved on. Maybe once upon a time, 20, 30 years ago, it would have been all about the company saying, oh, we've got this great pension that you can get and everything like that. And nowadays it's like, well, you can wake up in the morning, get your phone out, you can have a look at it, see if we've got any work for you. So yeah, life has shifted on, but I think it is a good opportunity because it's usually the last bit of the interview. And it's very important to make a good first impression on people, but it's also very important to make a good last impression on people.
Very true. Welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost. With me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Coming up, car insurance premiums soar, and as Jaguar launches its new baby SUV, will it be a hit? But first, for anyone interested in investing, from the newbies wanting to get started to the more experienced among you, Simon is definitely your man. From his super blog to the regular video on his website, The Investing Show. Now, this week on that show, Simon, you spoke to Gervais Williams. Private investors, he says, have an advantage over fund managers if they invest in small companies. He's been giving his tips on how to pick the best shares.
I think one of the ways of which I find most helpful is to look at them in terms of how you would run the business if you're running themselves. And when you look at the business and you think of the decisions they're making, you think, if I was in that position, are those the kinds of things I would be doing? So it's a really helpful way. And specifically, when you're buying companies, I often find it's best to buy them when they're in recovery mode. You can buy a company which is growing very nicely. It's got terrific opportunities. It may continue to grow for many years, as many of some of the small caps have done over recent years. But the danger is that those companies which are growing pretty well have to some degree, quite high expectations built in. Any particular missing of those expectations, downgrades and such like, can lead those share prices to suffer pretty badly. So I much prefer to buy companies which, for whatever reason, are either out of the limelight, not well received, people are a bit fed up with them, because those companies, if they surprise on the upside, can make crazy amounts of money. So recovery stocks like Bilby and others are absolutely the way forward. And I think private investors who are willing to do their own work actually have the advantage, particularly if they're not based in London, because many of the companies out of London really hardly see any institutional investors at all. And so you, as a local investor, can keep an eye on the plant. You can see how quickly, how much their car park is filling up each day or not filling up each day. You can keep an eye on generally their local products and see how many trucks are going in and out. All of that stuff can give you a better idea than many of the professional investors as to how the business is going.
So Simon, that was a snippet of your interview. What else did he say? What did you make of Gervais's comments?
Well, Gervais Williams was a very, very interesting guest on the Investing Show, to be honest. And I would say this because it's my show, but I would advise people to go to www.thisismoney.co.uk/investing show and watch the interview, because I think that he is one of those fund managers who can explain what they do and why they do it in very simple terms that people understand. He's very happy to talk about what he thinks makes a good company and what he thinks makes a bad company, and also to talk about those companies and give some examples. And I asked him at the end about investing in small companies, because small company investing is hugely popular with individual investors. So if you're an investor, you've got a couple of choices about what you do. You could invest in funds and get a fund manager to do the work for you, which is what Gervais Williams will do for you. You could invest in a tracker fund and just track a market. You could use one of the robo-advisors we were talking about last week, where someone else does all of the looking after it for you. Or at the other end of the scale, you could be picking shares yourselves. And picking shares yourself is one of the best ways to either make huge gains or come a serious cropper when it comes to investing. And often many private investors take a particular interest in small companies because small companies are much more interesting than big companies. You can get under the skin. You can understand a bit more about what they do than you read Shell and or BP results. They read like the complicated results of a mega bank. Whereas if you read the results of some small widget maker that's doing really, really well at the moment because it got this part that's going into electric cars and electric cars are booming, then you can understand that story. You can see where they might come good. And you can have the opportunity to strike it really big, or that company might go bust. And so it's really important to know the difference. And actually, I asked Gervais for some advice for those people. And he said that private investors, he thought, had the edge. Because they could go and they could have a look at these companies, they could delve into them, and that they had the ability to buy small amounts of shares, whereas fund managers have to buy into companies on a large scale. He also highlighted, you know, some companies that he thinks the reason why he likes them, and some of those would be things that he called recovery stocks. So companies that have been doing badly, or the market doesn't like, or investors don't like for some reason, and they've been beaten down too far. So there's value there. And basically, you can buy into them at a cheap price, and if you get it right, you can make quite a lot of money. But the other thing that he stressed, of course, is diversification. And that involves investing into a number of different companies that do different things and are not likely to all be affected by the same thing happening in the economy. So we've talked about this before. The maths behind it, there is a study. I can't remember the name of the study, but you need to be holding between 15 and 20 shares at a minimum. And they need to be in companies that do different things. So don't just hold 15 or 20 small cap mining shares, because then when the small cap mining sector gets absolutely walloped, every single one of the companies that you hold will do.
Eggs in baskets and all that. You spoke about electric cars. We'll get on to electric taxis very soon. But a little bit of bad news for drivers' insurance premiums. We're reading this week they've shot up, haven't they, to their highest level in 6 years, to an average of £847, which is up £100 in just 4 months. Now, this is according to the comparison website Confused.com. And sadly, it shows no sign of slowing down, with predictions that average premiums will race past £1,000 by 2018. So just next year. Lee, what's the reason for this?
Well, this is very comprehensive research, and it's 6 million quotes are analysed by Confused.com, and they've kept this series going for a long time. And you're right, I mean, it's the highest quotes for 6 years. We're about to hit a record. It might have already gone past that record now, actually, to be honest with you. And as you say, it could be an average of £1,000 to get insurance from next year. The two reasons that it's been put down to is the increase in insurance premium tax. So it's basically tax that insurers get charged, and of course they inevitably pass it on to drivers and other insurance products for that matter. The other big one was the change in the Ogden rate, which, without going into absolute massive detail on it because it's a real mind-bending subject, it actually means that insurers on the whole are going to be paying out more for personal injury claims. Now, I spoke to someone who's quite senior at one of Britain's major insurers, and they said that recently there was a payout for £20 million for a personal injury claim, where before, you know, these Ogden changes, it would have been more like about £8-9 million. So you can see where, you know, those a few of those a year, and they start adding that onto insurance premiums. There's no way back from this now. I don't think we're going to be seeing insurance rates getting cut anytime soon because of that Ogden rate, and because IPT is one of those things that has now been milked as a bit of a cash cow. It went up a little bit when Osborne. For a long time, it stayed
it's
the same
from
way.
Like 6 to 10 to 12.
And then even Hammond's nudged it up. Yeah. And nudge. And the thing is, you nudge it up any higher, we're going to be facing, you know, absolutely astronomical bills. And the trouble is with something like car insurance, if you start overpricing it, people just start to not buy it.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask you. Is there a danger that people just will drive uninsured?
There's definitely been research in the past. I remember the AA put out some research. Mm. I think maybe last time around when premiums started to really race ahead, and they were arguing that the more you keep charging people and more year on year these increases are, the more people are likely just to not get insurance, which is a very treacherous place to be. You don't want to be putting people off getting insurance. But unfortunately, that's a scenario that's happening at the moment. You know, it's getting more expensive to insure your vehicle, and people will probably get fed up.
Also, we had some stats. I don't know if it's related, but I imagine all these costs might be. Young people just not bothering to learn to drive?
Yeah, well, you can totally see it, can't you? I mean, the hourly rate of lessons, the expense of doing the test. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Sadly, a lot of people will have to, but it's not all gloom and doom for car lovers. Jaguar launches its new baby SUV, the E-Pace, in a bid to ramp up sales, and John Lennon's old psychedelic roller is back in town. But coming rather full circle on Uber, some good news at last for London cabbies in the form of a new electric taxi, which it's claimed could save them £100 a week, so the company says, in fuel. It's not British-owned, but it is British-made, so I guess, Simon, a bit of a win-win. Your views here?
Yes, the electric taxi can only be a good thing in my mind. I don't see any reason why electric taxis wouldn't be an excellent idea rather than noisy, dirty old diesel taxis. Can imagine how much of a benefit there would be if even just 50% of the taxis were electric in terms of noise and air pollution and things like that. And as the London Electric Vehicle Company, as the taxi making company that is owned by the Chinese company Geely, which also owns Volvo but makes its cars in the Midlands, pointed out, it could save cabbies £100 a week. And that's decent saving, that is. If you think about it, they're ideal for electric vehicle use. Might have to charge them maybe more than once a day, but if they had the kind of range where you could plug it in overnight, drive it the next day, or plug it in the morning when you come home from work and then drive it the next night, then it would be great.
All right, then, good news there. What about Jaguar's latest offering, though? We've seen the SUV effect all over the car industry, particularly now for smaller family-sized cars, from Nissan's Qashqai to Audi's Q3. But more exciting than even the Jag for Lee was this. Yeah, nothing to do with the amazing video of this car spinning around. Simon will explain that far better than me. It's just the music that Lee really likes. Yes, it is for a car. And there it goes. The car goes up on the ramp, Simon. It spins a little bit in the air in slow motion. And again,
Georgie, this is so
back. This is why I don't do voiceover work for car adverts. Lee, you're loving that, but Simon, explain what's just what I'm trying to explain far better. What am I seeing here?
I believe that what you may be doing is talking us through a barrel roll.
That's the one. I yes. remember the name. Something car related.
This is a jump. This is a move made famous in the 1974 James Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun. Remember Roger Moore?
I do.
And the barrel roll is basically a corkscrew, jump in the air. And the Jaguar E-Pace, which was launched quite literally yesterday.
Exactly.
Has won itself a place in the Guinness World Book of Records by performing the longest barrel jump. And actually, I'm not really one for car launch stunts.
That was an advert, by the way, that I played out. But yeah. We all decided that we rather liked the music and thought it would be very apt. Just thought I'd share that with you.
I'm not really one for car launch stunts, but this is a seriously impressive stunt. The car takes off, manages to spin in the air, land on its wheels. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/cars if you want to see it happen.
The launch was good.
Well, we only know what it looks like at the moment because nobody's been allowed to drive it or be inside it. But what we do know is that the market for these SUVs is huge and they are essentially the future of cars.
What's an SUV?
It's a sports utility vehicle. Okay. Does that help?
No.
In old days, you would have called it a 4x4.
Oh, right, yeah.
Except obviously a 4x4 only covers it if it's four-wheel drive, and a lot of these cars aren't four-wheel drive anymore. So a lot of the Nissan Qashqais and such cars that you see on the road are actually two-wheel drive. And so we've borrowed an Americanism. They're an SUV, a small SUV.
A Chelsea Tractor?
No, a Chelsea Tractor would be bigger, I think.
Okay.
Your Range Rover would be a Chelsea Tractor.
All right.
This is a smaller, less aggressive school run kind of car still takes up more room than it needs to, but people love these. When we were growing up, people had good old-fashioned saloon cars. Your dad had a saloon car, four doors and a boot, maybe a hatchback or an estate if you were a bit of a sporty family or had a dog. But nowadays people don't want that. They want a car that's higher up. They want it to be raised off the floor. They want that command driving position. They still want the practicality of the hatchback and the big boot. And what they want is a small SUV. And Jaguar launched its F-Pace SUV last year, which was its first one. And it has been a massive sales success. But it's a much bigger car. Mm. So now it's going after the smaller SUV market, the smaller premium SUV market. So
I'd say presumably cheaper, but actually probably not a lot.
Well, it's going to start at £28,500, so that's not a bad price for this kind of car. Mm-hmm. It's still a lot of money. It's basically they're going after the posh Qashqai market. So it's the Audi Q3, the BMW X3, BMW is soon to launch its X2 as well, the Mercedes GLC, premium cars, SUVs, raised up, command driving position. You can drive around in it feeling like you're in the lap of luxury. You can be an active family. You can put all your stuff in the boot, the buggy and everything, shopping. You can put your handbag in the central console. Apparently, this is a very important thing. But it's full of gadgets and tech and all these things that people want. They want to be able to connect their phone. And they want apps that they can get on the move. And it comes with an unbelievable amount of charging points for your USBs and your devices and everything like that. It's basically built for the modern family. It's a long way away from the traditional image of the Jaguar, the old-fashioned Jag, at the golf club or in the executive car park. But this is the way that the world is going, and Jaguar are probably going to sell an absolute ton of these cars because it looks good. It's a premium car at a price point that is accessible to many people with the help of a little bit of finance. This sector of car is proving hugely popular, and Jaguar sees this as key to massively ramping up its global sales. And I imagine that this will probably be a roaring success.
Can I add two things to this? Firstly, it threw up the term, it's going to be popular with the gin and jag belt, which is a great description of its key buyer market. Secondly, this is the first Jaguar to exclusively not be built in Britain. So it's going to be built in China and Austria. Just thought I'd point out, our readers have been a little bit... Yeah, so excitable about that in our comment section.
You've
about.
Just brought the whole tone down. There,
so the Chinese ones are for the Chinese market, because the Chinese market is huge. And the Austrian ones are for the UK, Europe and the rest of the world. And Jaguar have said that this is because they are basically operating at full capacity in the UK.
So
they can't actually make any more cars in the UK. But as Lee said, our readers haven't been particularly happy about that.
Well, just say it looks rather nice, but there's one image here, if you have take a look, which is sort of like swirly black and white ring things, the outside bit of it. I'm not
again,
a big fan of that.
Commentary,
I know, honestly.
are you talking about the image of the cub?
The what?
Where it beams Jaguar onto the floor.
No. The paintwork on the around the car, there's one of them which is not your normal red or your whatever. It's got black and white swirly bits. Don't even get me started.
Can I explain what that is?
Okay.
That's camouflage on a test car, because they didn't want people to see what the car looked like properly until they launched it. You're looking at one of the teaser shots on the test
car.
There's
a million
teaser
of them.
Shots.
Yes, that's in a story before it was launched. Oh. So the story after the launch, they did actually just put it in normal colours so people could see the car properly.
All right, great.
I'm sure if you were rich enough and fancied getting your car wrapped to look like that, you could do.
I wouldn't. The camouflage is not great. Which leads us on next, because goodness me, am I going to have to describe the psychedelic Rolls Royce of John Lennon? I really hope not. But do go to This Is Money for take a look at that. It is a vision of a car. The rear seat apparently was converted to a double bed. Would you expect anything less from John Lennon? A television, telephone, refrigerator were installed, along with a floating record player and a custom sound system, which included an external loud hailer, whatever that might be. But why is it back and where has it been?
It's very hard to imagine what it's like without having a look at the pictures on the website. But it's actually it's going to be on loan from a museum in Canada, which is where it was donated to. And it's part of eight Phantoms that are coming over. I mean, people are going to love it. It's probably going to be filling your Instagram feed any moment soon, because it is a very out there car. It really does look like a Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band album cover.
It's not
cover.
Camouflage, is it?
It's I don't know, Georgie. It's up to you. I mean, would you be happy to be driving that around? I mean, it's very John Lennon-esque, isn't it? I can only imagine John Lennon in his specs, sort of, you know, having to drive around. There was no charging points back in those days. There was no gadgets or gizmos. You just sort of drove around and enjoyed it. And the only way you could really pimp it up was to get some sort of outrageous paint job on it. And that is quite a statement, I would say. I think that would turn a few heads, I'd imagine.
I think so. Simon, your final views on this one?
Can you imagine how exotic...
Can you stop saying imagine? We got the joke, all right?
Oh, very good. I hadn't even thought of that.
Is that all you meant earlier?
Yeah, of course it was.
There you go, then. Come on, Simon.
Can you conjure up... how exciting it must have seemed to have a telephone, a television and a fridge in a car back then. It didn't come in the Rolls Royce. You had to have your Rolls Royce specially adapted. And nowadays they just stick them in any old family car.
Standard. How much would something like this go for though, Simon? I mean, you wouldn't sell it, would you?
Up for auction, John Lennon's. Quite probably... I reckon $500,000, maybe.
Because the
thing is, okay, yes, it's his car and it's painted like this, but the car itself is rare, but not that rare. The cars that sell for really big money is when the car itself is very, very rare, where there's not a lot of the individual cars that you can buy. And I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how much it was sold for last time. I can find out for you for next week's podcast if you
donated.
Like.
Sorry, I must have been wrong.
All right, then.
Yeah.
No, it was donated. I just don't know how much it was sold for before. Someone must have bought it at some point before they donated it.
I was going to say, we can't end on that.
That's such a poor end to a show.
Put the music back on.
Yeah. We'll do it. Quick, rescue the show, rescue the end. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. And don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk, or you can download the mobile app.